This is a 720 To Go podcast from Chicago's WGN Radio 720.
You know what they say, when it's time to feed your head, Milt Rosenberg's got the biggest ladle.
We are tonight talking about money, your money, my money, and the money that was coined 2,000 years ago or close to it, and all the other things that have been used for a currency, for exchange, apart from silver and gold and printed currency. My guests are two of the leading numismatists in town. They are Robert Feiler and Robert Leonard, both of them very important members of the Chicago, what do we call it, the Chicago Coin Club, not Coin Society, which has already passed its 90th anniversary.
Yes, we did.
So there's been a lot of numismatic interest in this town for quite some time. I must tell you, reading some of the materials you sent over, I made a delightful discovery. You sent me one article, probably from your journal, about... No, it wasn't in one of your articles. I guess I read this today, haunting Wikipedia and looking at the article on coins. I discovered, at any rate, whether it's in your publication or their publication, that the first stamped metal coin, of which we have any record, was produced on the island of Aegina, just south of Athens. And I spent a wonderful month in Aegina trying to write a book. A long, long time ago, but I had, and Aegina is an old, old Athenian city. It's just suburban to Athens, but over some water. But I had no idea that coinage came from there so far back.
Those have turtles on them.
That's the one, exactly.
A sea turtle is a silver stater. It's a coin about the size of a nickel, only very thick, very high relief, mm-hmm. with a sea turtle. But actually, even earlier than those are the coins of Lydia. The gold from the Pactoris River, which was the source of the riches of King Croesus at a later time, are thought now to have been issued at the toward the end of the 7th century B.C. And these are coins made of electrum, natural electrum, an alloy of gold and silver. And
Croesus was supposed to have been the ultimate gold hoarder of the ancient world.
That is right. He was the first, according to Herodotus, to make coins of gold and silver.
Yeah.
And by that, Herodotus meant that he made coins of gold and coins of silver, and discontinued the coins of a mixed gold and silver, the electrum, which had been the previous coinage.
Well, here we are in ancient Greece, 7th century, 6th century B.C. If you go back to say the 10th century B.C., which is considered probably to have been about the time of the actual Trojan Wars, though Homer wrote them up or recited the Trojan Wars in the 8th or 7th century B.C. But if you go back to 1000 B.C., essentially, how were they paying for things in Greece?
In Greece, slaves were a form of currency. Really,
any coinage at all?
No, there's no coinage. Homeric Greece is not exactly a full monetary economy. Tripods were used. We see in the ceramics, we see people carrying tripods, bronze tripods.
That's for exchange, is it?
No, because they used amphora, which are large ceramic vessels that have a pointed bottom. They needed a tripod with a circular opening to place these.
I need to get clarification on something. Let me turn to Robert Leonard on this. Obviously, exchange, and rather let me turn to Bob Feiler on this. Obviously, exchange was possible, and you could sort of pay for things long before there was coinage. And you could, there were other forms of material that stood in for what later on became coinage.
Barter.
But even before that, we have barter systems.
Yes.
How was exchange, how was purchase, or quote, purchase, handled, say, 2000 B.C.?
I would have to defer to my friend Bob Leonard, who has produced the book, on some of those different early pieces.
Yes, I have that book right here. I hold it in my hand. In fact, it's titled Curious Currency, the Story of Money from the Stone Age to the Internet Age. Okay, the Stone Age, that's more than 2000 B.C.
Yes.
There is no money in the Stone Age.
Well, I think the original hard asset was flint. Flint There were flint mines in England where in Grimes Graves and a couple of other places where the flint was mined using the antlers of red deer, red deer horn antlers as picks, and the shovels of shoulder blades of oxen as shovels to mine the flint, and it was shaped into rough outs for axes, for flint axes. And these were traded at considerable distances from the mines, and then they would be finished off by polishing by the end user.
But how would you set a price? Three flint axes, two flint axes? That's not very precise, is it?
No, well, this is prehistoric, so we don't have records by definition, but certainly they were trade items. They may have been money because they're all pretty uniform. Likewise, obsidian was traded in Central America. And in Anatolia, there was a big obsidian trade in Anatolia in the 7th century, 7th millennium B.C., actually, very early.
When do we really settle on coinage? When does coinage really get established?
In the, what are we talking, 750, 800 B.C.? Or was it even earlier than that? I have an example of a tetradrachm from Syria. 138 to 129 B.C.
You hold that in your hand.
This is a coin of Antiochus the VII.
Oh, really?
Who is the...
They had figured out how to refine silver by this point. They had billin prior to that, which was a combination. They had electrum. They could finally figure out some refining techniques.
You held it in your hand. Now I...
Yes, now you hold it in yours. Yes.
I hold it in my hand. And you say it's Antiochus.
Antiochus the VII, you know him. He's the cruel king of the Book of Maccabees.
Yes, exactly.
He's the king that fomented the Maccabean Revolution.
Because he tried to inflict Hellenic religion upon the Jews.
Exactly.
He tried to get them to shut down the temple.
And many of these coins allow us to be able to determine and learn more about the various rulers and what was going on, because there's so little available otherwise for dating purposes.
Antiochus, of course, is in the Hanukkah story, because Hanukkah begins when the Maccabees knocked over some of the forces of Antiochus and retook the temple, but they didn't have oil to relight the sacred lamp. Well, there was just a little bit of oil.
It might not last
for one night, but they poured it out and lit it, and it burned for seven days and seven nights, or something like that.
Yeah.
And thus, that has to do with the menorah as well. So there's an awful lot of history tied up in coins, is there?
Yes.
One famous bit of history relating to a coin, or a coin illuminating a bit of history, is, you will remember just what it was, I don't remember exactly, it must have been coined during the time of, during Caesar's time, or maybe Augustus after Caesar, namely the coin with Cleopatra on it, where we discover she had rather a prominent nose.
Yes.
Yes.
What coin is that exactly?
Well, there are several coins of Cleopatra. There's a coin, I think the one you're thinking of, is a silver tetradrachm, which is the same denomination as this coin we just looked at. A silver tetradrachm is a coin that's a little larger than a silver quarter, but rather thick. And about double thick, really, if you can imagine a silver quarter twice as thick. It has the portrait of Mark Antony on one side, and the portrait of Cleopatra on the other side.
Oh, well, then who issued it, actually?
Well, it was issued by Antony and Cleopatra, the
rulers.
Yes. It is not for not for her Egyptian territories. Cleopatra issued bronze coins in Egypt with her profile and her name and title, Cleopatra, Queen Cleopatra in Greek on the reverse, in two denominations. From Egypt, but the silver coin was issued for other territories, and there is a denarius of
this is a small
historical quiz question. We've talked about Antiochus, and then we've stumbled upon Cleopatra. What do they have in common in their lineage?
Ancient coins are not my specialty. I will defer to my friend Rob.
The question was Cleopatra and
Antiochus.
Well, they were both Greeks, and they were
exactly.
You're going to ask me, they actually are like cousins, if I'm not mistaken,
well,
because
both descend.
The two dynasties intermarried, I know that, the Seleucids and the Ptolemies.
And those dynasties were established upon the death of Alexander the Great.
Right.
Mm-hmm. When he divides up his empire into four locations, and he gives each one of those four to a separate major general.
Right.
And one goes to the Seleucids, and the other goes to the Ptolemies. And both Antiochus and Cleopatra are descendants of those dynasties. With that great historical clarification, and much history is available through coinage, isn't it?
That's
and
why we love
eliminates
it.
Much
why we love it
about history.
Yes.
And we'll go on with that when we return, right after we pause for these messages.
Milt Rosenberg, Extension 720, Chicago's WGN Radio 720.
We're talking about coins and about money generally, certainly paper money as well. We'll get to that in a while. And we're talking about the history of money and the fun you could have with money, quite apart from spending it, with Robert Feiler and Robert Leonard, who are leading members of the Numismatist Society of Chicago, which is called simply the Coin...
Chicago Coin Club.
Chicago Coin Club, the CCC. I think it's Keats who wrote the great sonnet Ozymandias, in which it begins, I met a traveler from an antique land who said, two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert, round about them the shattered visage lies, and so on. It's the statue of a great king, but now it's in the desert, it's desolate, and the head has been knocked off. But the motto on the trunk of the statue reads, my name is Ozymandias, king of kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. When somebody conquers, now he did it with he put statuary up to declare his importance and the fact that he was the conqueror, and you better bow down to me from here on, all of you lesser people. But other conquerors issue money with their own pictures, don't they?
Yes, although not always with pictures. Genghis Khan, who was a Muslim, or at least not a Christian anyway, his coins are strictly inscriptions. Same thing for Tamerlane.
But what are these? What do the inscriptions tell you?
Just a title or his name and a title, that's all. There's no, unfortunately, there's no claim, and maybe that's not the best example.
They don't say, look on my works, ye mighty.
Not that. We have to go back to somebody like Caligula, who was not really a great conqueror, who...
he was a great mad emperor.
Yes, he made claims which... on his coins, which are not true. There we have coins commemorating victories that had not in fact happened, in anticipation of the victory, but it never happened.
That was before he made his horse a member of the Roman Senate.
Yes, I believe so, because that was the last straw that triggered his assassination.
Shortly after that, they killed him.
And didn't Vlad the Impaler make some coins, the Dracula? But
no,
but they don't
Vlad
have a picture.
The Impaler
he had some
did
coinage.
Not have their mint right. His father...
Or his father did, but they didn't have pictures.
No, there's no... Well, they have a bird on them.
Come to a more recent time, a great conqueror, to be sure, Napoleon.
Yes.
What do we have of Napoleon? He's vastly commemorated in the paintings of Jacques David and in all sorts of stylings and so on. He must be all over the place with regard to money, both printed and metallic currency.
Coinage, tokens, box tokens, tokens
metal.
With pictures inside, medals... Many, many, many.
Does he still
Napoleon
persist
medals.
In French currency? I think not.
I am not
I
aware
don't
of it currently.
I believe so. Now, he issued coins, and his coins have this title, emperor, of course.
Yeah.
But not money, but the French mint, the Paris mint, issued an enormous series, hundreds of medals commemorating every possible victory or
every battle,
claimed
every victory.
Victory and battle. Of Napoleon, they're really, really beautiful. High relief, bronze medals, larger than silver dollars.
In this country, we must have commemorated all of the presidents. Does every president have a coin, or did he have?
Not yet.
Not yet.
Not yet.
We're working our way there.
Who's left out?
Well, let me see. We're up to, 16
the
or
current,
something
The current
now?
Presidential We're... dollars are being released five per year, right? Five per year, four,
I believe
five per year.
So. And
five per year, and we did the states initially with the quarters. Now we're doing the presidents with the dollars, and we're into year two and a half or so.
But we have some recent presidents. Surely Kennedy is on our regular quarters.
On our half dollars.
Or half dollars.
Yeah, he's on the half dollars.
Which other recent presidents are in coinage at the moment?
Recent
presidents? Well, certainly
Franklin
Roosevelt, if you consider him recent.
Dime,
But Eisenhower isn't on a coin yet.
Eisenhower's on a dollar.
Yeah.
He's on a dollar.
Eisenhower
the dollar
in
coin.
The 70s.
Silver dollar, you mean?
It was
it's
copper nickel.
Really. Yeah. It's a clad dollar. There was a silver version, but the circulating was not silver.
And, of course, Lincoln was on our pennies.
The Lincoln penny was the basic penny. And he was also on a $5 bill and was used on currency for a long time.
Yeah.
It still is.
Has the Lincoln penny been withdrawn? Did I read that someplace?
No.
They keep talking about it. I don't think it's ever going to happen. People have a strong emotional tie to it.
But the point is the penny is not really a meaningful coin anymore, is it?
Not hardly. And we numismatists refer to it as a cent. They say the U.S. never made a penny. They only made a cent. The Brits made its pennies.
Yeah.
But we all laugh about it.
The United States has a decimal system. I don't think people really appreciate this.
Mm-hmm.
10 mils make a cent. 10 cents make a dime. Canada does not have a dime. The United States has a dime. 10 dimes make a dollar. And then $10 make an eagle, although the eagle was a gold coin, but it's not used really as money. We only use the cent, the dollar, and for tax purposes, the mil.
When it comes to paper currency, one of the fascinating... The design of paper currency is good. We were talking about French money before. French paper currency looks like comic books.
They're beautiful, yes.
But why do I say comic books?
Well, they're very, very colorful. They're stylized. They're done almost in a balloon fashion, very beautiful.
With large sort of pastel colors.
Large pastels.
It could be off a comics page.
Yes, very much so.
I've never seen any other currency quite like that.
The Swiss currency is particularly colorful, very ornate, very difficult to counterfeit, if not impossible.
Speaking of counterfeiting, why does this happen almost every time I went shopping? Usually in a supermarket, when I present a $50 bill.
They hold it up to the light.
The girl behind the counter will almost always hold it up to the light.
Hold it up to the light.
And
to look
often
at.
Also put a pencil mark on it. Why? Obviously, they're worried about...
They're looking for the security strip to see if it's authentic, which they're even figuring out how to counterfeit little phony strips, and the counterfeiting pen will react with the inks in the paper.
Well, tell me about the security strip. What is it?
The security strip is microprinting, which repeats the denomination of the bill. On your $50 bill, it's got 50 in microprinting numerous times on the little strip that you can read if you hold it up to the light.
Well, why can't counterfeiters imitate that as well?
It's very, very, very difficult to do. But with the high-speed scanners and technology, this is why we have to keep changing currency every few years to try and stay a step ahead of the counterfeiters.
Well, why? So there must be a lot of counterfeit $50 bills out there in the world.
Phenomenal amounts of. I think
hundreds.
The 20 is the most commonly counterfeited.
Well, I was about to ask, why not the 20?
I think the 20 is the most counterfeited.
But they don't hold the $20 bill up to the light.
A lot of places won't take anything above a $20 bill.
Really?
50s or 100s because of the counterfeiting problem.
Huh.
Hundreds. Actually, I think hundreds are the most counterfeited outside the United
outside
States.
Outside
the U.S. A very high percentage of U.S. paper money circulates outside the United States.
Mm-hmm.
They used to call the former Eastern Bloc the 13th Federal Reserve District because people trusted the U.S. dollar so much more than the local currencies in the former Eastern Bloc.
Well, that's still true the world over, I would
yes,
say.
Yes, it is.
But pretty soon the Chinese yen will replace it, apparently.
Yes, yes. We wonder.
There's a fascinating story, which is in an article that you sent me. I don't know whether it appeared originally in your journal or elsewhere, about what happened at the Sachsenhausen concentration camp in Nazi Germany during the war, when they were...
The Bernhard Project, right?
It's called
Project Bernhard. Yeah.
Project Bernhard. In which they were attempting to counterfeit not American currency, but rather the British pound.
The plan was to destabilize the British government by flooding the market with ultra-high-grade counterfeit 5-pound banknotes and other denominations, and they were working very far ahead on the U.S. currency also, with the same plan to demonetize, destabilize.
And I gather their counterfeiters they were prisoners to begin with. They were mostly Jewish.
They were Jewish engravers, highly skilled at what they did, and under penalty
of death.
They stayed
alive.
They had to do their best work to stay alive.
There's a film about this.
There's a film called The Counterfeit, an excellent film.
Who ran the whole project? Who conceived it?
It was one of Hitler's generals. Was it Goering? No, I don't remember.
I don't remember.
But they
the
ran
name.
It very secretively. It was a very, very secret project. Mm-hmm. The commandant of the camp did not know what they were doing in this sequestered little area. Very, very.
And did much of that money get circulated in England, actually?
They ran it through Switzerland.
They sorted it into four categories of quality. And the worst quality, actually, some of it was dumped by airplane over England, you know, the very worst quality. Hmm. They had a spy, Cicero, I think it was, in Istanbul.
Famous spy in Istanbul. Yeah,
and he
working
was,
in the German embassy
was,
in Istanbul.
Yes, and he was paid in this counterfeit money. And I can't remember if he was paid in the best quality or the second best quality. Uh-huh. But anyway, he was paid in counterfeit money. And it was used, of course, to buy things.
You know, that raises a fascinating question. What makes my $50 bill worth $50? There was a time, I suppose 50 years ago, when printed money said, you can turn this in. Said, in essence, you can turn this in and get the value back in metal. But it no longer says that, and you can't do that. Though I suppose if I asked you to give me... to give me, how many quarters would it take? $50 bill would take
200 quarters.
If I asked somebody to give me 200 quarters for a $50 bill, if I went to the bank and asked them for that, they would do so.
Yes.
But what gives the $50 bill or the $100 bill, what gives our money that kind of redeemable value? Or rather, how do we come to believe that it has that value? Yeah. Fascinating questions there, relating really to higher finance and to some of the troubles we may be in this country as we go on paying out vast amounts of, as building our debt to higher and higher super trillion levels. We return to the two Bobs, namely Robert Leonard and Robert Filer, after we pause.
This is Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg, Chicago's WGN Radio 720.
And back to the two numismatists who have joined us tonight, Robert Filer and Robert Leonard, leading members of the Chicago Coin Club. And actually, Robert Leonard is as well the author of a book titled Curious Currency, The Story of Money from the Stone Age to the Internet Age. That's published by Whitman Publishing. And the question I was raising a moment ago, what gives paper money the value, or how do they come to get us to believe, whether we should or should not, to believe that it really has that value? And all currency systems depend upon people believing in that illusion.
They used to say the full faith and credit of the government.
There we are.
That's what they used to say.
And you deal with that in the very first chapter of your book.
Yes. The American Numismatic Society of New York opened an exhibit at the History of Money at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York back in 2002, and Alan Greenspan, at that time chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, made opening remarks, and he said, to accept money in exchange for goods and services requires a trust that the money will be accepted by another purveyor of goods and services. In earlier generations, that trust adhered to the intrinsic value of gold, silver, or any other commodity that had general acceptability. And so I define money as anything used to make a payment that the recipient trusts can be reused to make another payment.
One hears stories of the great inflation in Germany after World War I, when Deutschmarks doubled or tripled day by day, so that ultimately to buy a loaf of bread you need to carry a wheelbarrow,
full of
that's
currency.
The story, full of currency to turn it in for the loaf of bread. There was no full faith in that currency anymore. What's the worst inflation the United States has ever experienced?
There were two major inflations. The first was the during the Revolutionary War, the Continental Currency. Mm-hmm. Was redeemed at $1 in silver for $40 in paper. So that's 97.5% repudiation. The state of North Carolina, or the repudiated the entire issue. It became completely worthless. Nobody got any money. Of course, in the Confederacy, the Confederate money became entirely worthless. So those are 100% loss. So I would say those are the most historically, but of course if we look back at inflation, we can see that the purchasing power of the dollar, even though it's still exchangeable for dimes and so on, is only 1% of what it was not that long ago, at the beginning, about 100 years ago.
But I still trust my dollar or my $10 bill because I know that you will take it in exchange for something that I get
exactly.
from you, and you will use it to buy something else.
And the British, up until about 20 or 30 years ago, were holding vast quantities of Confederate-issued bonds and monies in hopes that they could get the U.S. current government to still stand good by it because the Confederacy was absorbed into...
But they gave up on that.
But they fairly recently, and a lot of those bonds came back over onto the collector's market in the last, what, 70s, early 70s, mid-80s?
Yeah, the early 80s, I think. I don't think it was the British government. I think it was private investors
private
who purchased
investors.
These. They were sold by the Confederacy. Of course...
But now they have only souvenir.
Actually, they have considerable souvenir value, and they got...
The old saying used to be, the South shall rise again, and this is a Confederate $100 bill, and the retail value of it is around $100 now. South has risen.
They actually are worth face value now. It's taken a long
is
time.
Is that so?
Yes.
Explain to me and to all who are listening what gold still has to do with our currency. What's all that gold doing down at Fort Knox?
It's on the books still at, I think, $35 or $70 an ounce. They jacked it up, but it's not...
No, I don't understand this. It has to do, I think, with the 1933 Act or something. It's carried at $42 and I think 42 cents, and it doesn't make any sense.
What does that mean, it's carried at 42 cents?
They carry it on the books.
If you look at the value, the statement of the assets of the Treasury Department, there are all these ounces of gold, and instead of valuing them at $1,200 or, you know, whatever they really would bring, they are valued at $42.42, which is some kind of an accounting fiction, and they could be revalued. Now, in Germany a few years ago, the German government wanted to revalue the German gold assets from the fictitious value they were carried to market value. And that would erase a lot of debt, but there was such an uproar they never did it.
But valued or correctly or valued fictitiously, what does that have to do with the worth of our paper currency? How does it back our paper currency?
It's a reserve. They could be sold on the market and the money and the bonds redeemed. I mean, it's an asset that we hold.
So that's the full faith of the federal government.
That's the full faith. We went off the silver standard, got rid of our silver certificates in 1964. The last silver coinage we had was 1964. Things after that is full faith and credit.
A quick change of pace, a quick change of subject. What's the most beautiful currency in the world these days? So it's a matter of going from historicity to aesthetics. What really appeals to you?
The currency, the paper money of Switzerland, is particularly beautiful to me. It's very, very well done. The Bahamas have very, very beautiful currency. Bob, what do you think?
Well, I think most paper money, except the United States, with all these pastel colors, is very attractive. Yeah, but Switzerland has got butterflies.
You think ours is unattractive comparatively, do you?
Unimaginative.
Well, yes, it is, certainly. It's... this is radio, so we can't prove that.
We all know what money is.
Right. But however, if anyone goes on the internet and looks at the, you know, the banknotes in full color of these other countries and compares it to the money in their wallet, I think
gorgeous.
They will agree with
gorgeous.
Us.
They're like miniature.
Well, why have we remained so bland?
Conservatism.
Conservative for the same reason we don't get rid of the U.S. cent, for the same reason we don't get rid of the U.S. $1.
Uh-huh.
Other countries, Canada's gotten rid of the $1 and the $2 bill. Other countries in Northern Europe that are not on the euro have gone to bigger denominations.
Would you say our coinage ranks better in the world than our paper money? Just in terms of aesthetics, again.
No. Definitely not. Worse. What the U.S. Mint did, this will be of interest to our listeners, I think. Back about 15 years ago, they decided to save money. They instituted a cost reduction. Our coins are struck from dies, and there is a what's called a hub, which looks like a coin in relief, And this hub is used to make a die, a master die, and the master die is used to make hub to make working dies. The mint, to get the full relief on the earlier coins, if you look at the coin, the Washington quarter from the 1980s, you can see the relief on it. And if you look at one from the 2000s, you can see that it's much lower relief. And the reason for that is that they used to take two impressions of the master hub to raise the a working die. Now they by lowering the relief, they can do it in a single one. So there's one impression instead of two to make the die.
And this is a matter
so
of
the dies are lower relief.
Is this a matter of cost cutting as well?
Yes,
or
yes. It's a 50% reduction in the cost of making
that,
dies. And it's a 50% or more reduction in the aesthetics of the coins. The coins look terrible. They look like bus tokens.
And we're using higher speed presses, and the presses can run 600, 800, 1,000 strokes per minute, running multiple blanks or planchets at one time, flying them out like popcorn. And the reproduction quality.
We are about to pause for a quick round of commercials. This is our commitment to supporting capitalism as best we can. When we return, something we haven't talked about at all is coin collecting, is numismatics from the point of view of the collector, and the crucial and fascinating question of what determines value.
Good questions.
And what are some of the items of tremendous value and why? And what are some of the items that people think are of tremendous value but are not and why? We'll be back to Robert Feiler and Robert Leonard directly after these words.
Milt Rosenberg, Extension 720, Chicago's WGN Radio 720.
I have before me on my computer screen the website for this very program, Extension 720. The box on top is headed Daily Update. We change it every day, and it reads tonight, Thursday, August 19th, God was left out of the Constitution but was furnished a front seat on the coins of the country. Mark Twain coined that maxim, and on the program tonight, coins will be the topic of discussion. Joining Milt are Chicago Coin Club members Robert Feiler, a collector and dealer in U.S. coins and paper money, and Robert Leonard, author of Curious Currency, the Story of Money from the Stone Age to the Internet Age. And I might note that where it says Chicago Coin Club, that's printed in a different color, and if you click on that, it will take you, it's a link, of course, take you directly to the Chicago Coin Club for all the information about them. I guess from their, what's up is their current newsletter.
Yes.
While we're talking about it, though, on the same webpage for Milt's file, which you get to by going to wgnradio.com/extension720, you will find the new kind of podcast we've been doing called Podcast Exclusive. That is to say, we're doing them only in podcast form. They are not on the air. There are so many good people coming through, we can't work them all in on the air, so we've started doing 40 to 60 minute interviews with some outstanding people who have been lined up for discussion. One of them being, for example, Arthur Brooks, the president of the American Enterprise Institute. Another being Jim Lehrer, the well-known television newsman and indeed a wonderful sort of comic novelist as well. On the same website, you'll find yet other podcast exclusives, and you'll find other recent programs which were over the air and are now available to you in podcast form. You will also find, if you just scroll down a bit, something titled Audio Archives, which reads as follows. These are programs of which we are most proud. They go back to 1996 and come up to the present, where a month is listed, for example, April 2001. If you hit more, you will find three or four separate programs. Browse, listen, by stream or download, and enjoy. In fact, everything we have here is available to you through all the available download technologies, all the streaming technologies. So you can also download them and listen at your leisure in bed or driving to work or on the beach or what have you. That is then the Extension 720 program website at wgnradio.com/extension720. And with that, let's talk then about collecting. You're both collectors.
Yes.
Your club, the CCC, is full of collectors, obviously. How many are in it, by the way?
We have a little over 100 members, what is it, about 120. The youngest young fellow from comes in from Aurora with his mother. He's in high school, entering high school. We have another fellow just in college, wrote a book, and active maybe 30 or so per month to show up at the meetings.
And it's a major hobby, if one wants to call that a hobby. A hobby seems to minimize things in a way. But lots of people are collectors around the country, around the world.
Yes.
And there are international societies and national societies and so on. One of the basic issues, of course, is what do you go after? Do you go after value or do you go after particular themes?
Well, as my friend Bob says, buy what you collect. That's the easy part. Don't buy what you don't collect. That's difficult. Bob is laughing because we've both seen people go to a major coin show, walk through, got a few dollars in their pocket, eyes like dinner plates. They see something, they snag it up and buy it. Bob would agree with me on this. We always tell people, buy the book before you buy the coin. Spend 10 or 15 bucks on a book, turn off the TV, spend an evening reading through it, get a little knowledge. Knowledge is power. And we all say that over and over and over, and yet we know people that just go out and buy stuff off the internet,
so
off the newspaper.
So if I suddenly decided I'll be a collector of Napoleonic coins,
yes,
before I start buying them, I got to find the book.
You could find the book, or you could talk to a club like ours where we have a Napoleonic coin and metal collector, extremely knowledgeable. And all
you actually have one?
We do, yes, and we're happy to share Charlie Ricard, and we're happy to share information about where to go for more information, and it's the joy of the hunt. That's why we do it.
And you have to learn what the proper pricing is, because you may pay much more than something is worth.
It is very possible to pay more.
What market? How does the market work that sets the value on coins?
Well, the usual answer is supply and demand, but my feeling is it's demand more than supply. There are rare items that are not in demand that are worth very little, and there are pretty common items that are in incredible demand that sell for a lot of money.
What would be an example?
You can have ancient coins. I have a couple of ancient coins I put out at a little table locally. I can sell an ancient coin for $15 or $20. It's from the time of Christ.
Uh-huh.
I make a profit on it. It's not rare.
They're
that cheap. They found them with metal detecting in the last 20 years. There's a lot of them available. There's not a lot of people collecting. Yet there are very current Lincoln cents and other current U.S. money that's very sought after, whether it's an error, that's worth a great deal of money.
What Lincoln pennies are worth a great deal? Everyone's going to dip into their pockets or the dresser drawer looking at Lincoln pennies right now. What Lincoln pennies are worth a particularly large amount?
Well, they're really not in circulation anymore. The only ones that are likely to have a premium, I would say, would be the ones with the wheat ears on the back. There's a few exceptions, but it would be hard to describe.
With what on the back?
The wheat ears as opposed to the Lincoln Memorial. In 1959... the design was changed to the Lincoln Memorial. Previous to that, 1909 to 1958, it shows two wheat ears flanking the words 1 cent.
Yeah.
Okay, so those are worth some. They're all worth supreme.
Yeah.
What, 3 cents or something?
Yeah, they were bringing
that
3 or 4 cents each. They were melting them down for a while because of the copper value. There were certain early first years that were quite valuable. The 1909 San Francisco Mint with the Victor D. Brenner initials, the 1914 Denver Mint cent
was
worth a lot. 1914 Denver Mint in very good condition, a couple of $300.
Uh-huh.
A 1922 error where the D didn't print or mint out could be worth several hundred dollars. They're counterfeited very heavily. People used acid to remove the mint mark. There were 1931 San Francisco.
So there is much faking of rare coins.
It's an ongoing problem, and it has been even in ancient times.
Huh.
Yeah, there are problems with alteration. This is more alterations, where a genuine coin is altered to appear to be a rare coin, but there are certification, grading and certification services that one can send coins to where they can be examined and sealed in a plastic holder, a slab, and that will give a collector the assurance that the coin is genuine.
What's the most expensive coin sale in recent years?
Let's see, there was a $7 million sale recently. Oh, I know what it was. It was the
Was it the 1913?
No, not that. It's the 1794 dollar that Steve Contursi sold to some kind of foundation, numismatic foundation, for over $7 million.
This was a private... $1794 dollar from where?
The United States. The first year of silver dollars in the United States, first coinage of silver dollars in the United States was in 1794, and not many were made. 1700 was the mintage, and a few were saved in very high grade, and one of these was sold. It's been exhibited for years as the finest known or the first one made and so on, and it was sold very recently this year for over $7 million. So I would say that is the most valuable, and I believe that's higher even than the 1933 Double Eagle, which was supposedly the only one in private hands, which was sold at auction about 8 years ago for also about $7.5 million. So those are both United States coins.
And then the 1913 Liberty Nickel, the one that turned
four and a half million.
Yeah, that was missing for many years, and that showed up. There were only five made.
When it comes to the making of stamps, there are some people who, at the place that issue stamps, who sometimes produce an intended error for a small issue, which then will have great value. Does the same happen in mints?
It has happened.
Yes, in my opinion. When the small size dollar came out, the Sacagawea dollar, it is not much bigger than a quarter dollar. In fact, if you recall, when the Susan B. Anthony dollar came out, people confused them with quarters. And so when the Sacagawea was introduced, the color was changed from white to the brass color. And coins were found in circulation that have the obverse of a dollar, but the reverse of a quarter.
Gentlemen, with that, we're about to pause for an update on the news. But before that, it is time to say, and indeed I hereby announce, we'll be going to the phones directly after the newscast, because we expect lots of people will have interesting questions about coins and about paper currency and about the history of money generally. And if you actually have something in your hand or in your pocket or in the dresser drawer that strikes you as a rare coin and you want to know something about it, not merely its value, but also something about its issue and something about its story, give us a try. If anybody can answer your questions, it is undoubtedly our two guests tonight, Robert Feiler and Robert Leonard. So, the lines are open at this moment, 312-591-7200.
You're listening to Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on Chicago's WGN Radio 720.
And back to our two money men, Robert Leonard and Robert Feiler. And almost instantly back to your or onto your phone calls. Do you know the wonderful bit of doggerel by Hilaire Belloc? I'm tired of women, I'm tired of wine, but money delights me all of the time. But he means just because you can, it's riches. Money delights you for yet other reasons.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. How did you get involved with money?
I was a little kid living on the north side. My dad was a janitor, a woman living in the building, gave my mom a little purse of coins, played with them on the floor. I was about seven, saved birthday, holiday money, went down to Fields, dragged my mother down there, bought a book. I bought the book first. And it became a lifelong hobby. My wife calls it an obsession.
That's Robert Feiler's story of his obsession. What about Robert Leonard?
I started collecting Lincoln cents and Indian head cents when I was 8 years old. You could still find Indian head cents in circulation, or people had them laying around they would give to me. Collected them by Dayton Mint and also Liberty Ed Nichols and Buffalo Nichols. And then when I went to college, I decided to change to just collecting by type and collect world coins and traded off my scarce dates for those.
With that, gentlemen, on to the phones. Many people want to talk with you. 312-591-7200. If you're trying to reach us now, you're not getting through. All the lines are taken. But, of course, a line is available as soon as we say goodnight to a prior caller. So try again at that moment. And here is the first caller of the evening. Pat, good evening.
Hi there. I have always heard about this aluminum cent, that only a limited amount were made, and they were given to senators and representatives and then they were recalled, and some of them got into circulation. And the kicker is, if you had one and they found out, the FBI would raid your house. Is it true?
It's...
You want me to...
Go ahead, Bob.
In 1973-74, the price of copper had gone way up, and the Mint experimented with making cents of aluminum and changing the material from copper to aluminum, and they just assumed, I think, that the Congress would approve this, would rubber stamp it. So a number of patterns were made and taken to a congressional hearing, passed around. The congressman looked at them, and it didn't happen. The alloy was never changed. And then later they went to try to recall them. I don't think anybody would be arrested, but they are subject to seizure. They're considered U.S. government property.
Yeah, it's illegal to own.
Hmm.
So it's still called the illegal cent.
You could say
you
that.
Could.
And here
you
I
could
thought
say
somebody
that.
Was sitting on this wonderful treasure.
We can only hope. But then they couldn't sell it if they did
they
have it.
They can't be legally sold in the United States.
It's like a 1933.
It just remains sitting upon it. We thank you, ma'am, for the call.
Thank you.
Nice
to have
heard from you. And 312-591-7200 at this moment. One line is available. We go next to Tom, who's joined us at WGN Radio. Good evening.
Well, good evening, Professor. I'd like to ask your guest tonight, one, there was a brief reference a moment ago. Whatever happened to the store that used to be in Marshall Fields?
It closed. It moved to North Avenue, about a block west of Harlem Avenue, on the south side of North Avenue, Route 64.
Is it still there today?
The store is still there. I was in there a couple months ago. Nice folks.
Are there many coin dealers in town?
There are a number of coin dealers around. The number has diminished over the years because of not as many kids going into it and the electronics age. And the collecting gene doesn't seem to be going as strongly.
When it comes to ancient coins, Harlan Burke is one such dealer, is he not?
Harlan Burke is an excellent dealer. Clark in Washington, he has a club that he sponsors, Ancient Coin Club of Chicago. Very knowledgeable, and they share that knowledge. Very nice folks.
And Milt,
yes,
I have a second question.
Please.
And that is, if your guests could speak, if they know of it, about George Smith's script and the early Illinois currency that or forms of negotiable currency that was circulated.
Now, who was George Smith?
Now, George Smith, was that the Bank of America note, or was Seth Payne?
No, it's not that. He was the insurance.
Oh, that's
he
right.
was the insurance company that that got a charter to run an insurance company and managed to issue all this paper money and became extremely wealthy.
Yeah.
And retired. What he went back to Scotland.
Back
did
to
he
Scotland.
Not?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mike Matra wrote a souvenir card about that. The script is valuable as a collectible, if that's your question.
Well, I was particularly interested in the role that he played and his bank and currency in early Illinois history and really the economy of the Upper Great Lakes and the Old Northwest Territory.
Prior to 1861-62, there was not a formalized system for the production and distribution of paper currency. So of necessity, the further out west you went, the more individual stores, merchants, the local tavern, the local general store had to issue their own paper money.
How would they back the money?
Well, they would back it by the full faith and credit of their local reputation.
Uh-huh.
So that if you were in downtown Chicago and you had Potter Palmer currency, which he did, everybody in Chicago knew Potter Palmer. He's a good guy. The money's real good. You went out to Aurora, it was okay. But if you went out to Quincy, they might discount it 25 or 30 or 50%. And if you went out to Kansas City, they said, "Who the heck is Potter Palmer?"
But there was no national currency available.
There wasn't really. It was a very.
No.
It was very loose. Some states had some control. On a railroad, you might have monies and currency from dozens of
well,
different.
When
issuers.
Did we first fully establish federal currency?
1861 with the greenback dollar.
Not until then.
Yeah.
Not till the Civil War. Then we had the
the
national. Yeah, the greenbacks, the national currency, which we have had ever since.
Uh huh. Our thanks to the caller. An interesting set of questions. 312-591-7200 is the number. And Dan has joined us. Good evening, sir.
Thanks for taking my call.
Our pleasure.
Questions about U.S. coins.
Yes, sir.
One is, why did they make so many darn nickels in 1964?
It's due to the coin shortage. And actually, that is a frozen date, I believe. I believe that the silver coins dated 1964, were made as into 1966, actually, some of them. There was a...
They didn't change the date.
The date was basically frozen. There was a collector set dated 1965, but made very late in the year. It's a...
the book
it's
lists.
Due to the coin shortage with the vending machines. I don't think it's coin hoarding, but perhaps that's what Senator Bible thought it was.
Yeah, the book lists 2¾ billion 64 nickels made that year. Billion with a B.
Can I ask my next question?
Yes, sir. Go ahead, please.
Are there any U.S. era coins that have the same thing on both sides, you know, like heads and heads, tails and tails?
That? No.
Not as errors. The dies can't really be mated that way. There have been stuff that's gotten out of the mint, but these are not errors. They are intentionally made by unscrupulous workmen. I don't believe there are any double-headed coins, even from other countries, that are true errors.
I know of none. Any that I've seen are altered magician's coins. There was a company in Michigan making them. They're novelties. You can buy them at coin shows for a very minimal amount of dollars.
And, sir, we thank you for the call. We will pause right now for the usual reasons. Speaking of money, there are ways to extract money from you, but you get value back in full and sufficient balance. And here are some of the items and services through which that whole thing can be properly managed.
Milt Rosenberg, Extension 720, Chicago's WGN Radio 720.
And back to the phones in an instant. But before that, there's an object that's been lying on this table all night long. It looks like a double boomerang or something. What is it?
It's a Katanga cross. It's a copper cross weighing about 2.5 pounds, about 9 inches on a side, and cast by the copper miners in Katanga in Central Africa in sand molds made with their fingers. And this was the principal form of money in the Katanga region of Central Africa.
Katanga is a province in the Congo, I said.
In the Congo, yeah. Right. And in the 1920s, 5 or 6 of these crosses would buy a wife.
Aha. Uh-huh. So ultimately it's redeemable in wives.
In a manner of speaking.
Uh-huh. It's odd currency. And, of course, it's one of the things featured in your recent book, Curious Currency, the Story of Money from the Stone Age to the Internet Age. What happens in the Internet Age with regard to money?
Well, in the Internet Age, we have things like PayPal. In the Internet Age, we have things like PayPal and...
to be sure we do, yes.
Electronic funds, transfers.
Credit cards, yes, debit cards, that sort of thing.
Yeah, you're right, that's all money one way or another.
And yes, wire transfers, store value cards, this is the sort of things that... we are using now in place of big copper crosses.
And when I buy a book from Amazon, I charge it to my American Express card.
It's the time value of money, instant transfer, instant gratification.
And instant gratification for our listeners. I hope we go back to the phones, 312-591-7200. And Kathy joins us at WGN Radio. Good evening.
Good evening, gentlemen. My husband passed away in May, and he was a chemist. So I went through all of his chemistry books, and he had bookmarks. But in the German chemistry books, there were 10 silver certificates, $1 bills. What is there a value to these?
Are they the same size as the currency you have in your pocket or wallet now?
Well, they look a little smaller. It says series 1957.
Okay, 1957, yeah. If they're crisp uncirculated, never been bent, they're worth a few dollars each. Perhaps a little more. You would have to take them to a coin shop, let somebody look at them. If you're in the Chicagoland area, you can check on the internet or phone book, look for a local coin shop.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you. It was just, you know, of all the books to be through, it was the German chemistry books that had the silver certificates.
Safekeeping.
Yes. Thank you for answering my question.
Well, thank you for the call. I'm glad to help. 312-591-7200. And on to the next caller, who turns out to be Ian, here on WGN Radio. Good evening.
Yes, good evening, Dr. Rosenberg. I heard y'all talking about coins, and I have a few, particularly, I'm interested in Greek coins, and so I remember somebody asking me back in 1979 when the Soviets busted into Afghanistan. I was asked what I thought about it, and I said, well, maybe at least they'll do some archaeology. Because I had read that in 1961, when Afghanistan still had a king, he was out falcon hunting and stumbled over something and turned out to be the stump of a Greek column. And they excavated this city, the name of it still unknown. But I've seen coins from Afghanistan, well, it's called Bactria back then, and they're among the finest Greek coins ever minted. I mean, the portraitures on them are just so fine, and the reverse even is elegant. And I was wondering if your guests knew anything about those.
I would predict they know just about everything about that.
Well, I'm going to disclaim knowledge of everything, but I'm familiar with these coins. The Bactrian kingdom was the easternmost remnant of the original empire of Alexander the Great, and these coins date from the 3rd and 2nd century BC primarily, were engraved, the portraits of the kings of Bactria engraved by Greek artists. And they are extraordinarily well done. They wear some of them wear very unusual headgear. Later we have degenerate Greek inscriptions and inscriptions in Indian language. Indian language is on the reverse.
It's in Bactria that the Alexandrian army turns right and heads down to the Hindu Kush and beyond. The invasion of India, mm-hmm. after they've been in Bactria or in modern Afghanistan. Yeah.
A lot more of this coinage is coming out as people are able to get in with metal detectors into these very, very remote areas, which is one of the reasons that the more common ancient coin prices have kept low, because there's a lot of them, but not a lot of collectors.
Well, I happen to have a coin from Leukas, a city on the western coast of Greece, part of the Corinthian League, back in the late 5th century. And it's got the Athena with the Corinthian helmet, and on the reverse, Pegasus. A very fine example that I found for a mere $90, and I've seen inferior specimens for like $600. So it seems the prices range wildly. But another thing, before I forget, I heard recently on the BBC, it was just mentioned in passing almost, that a huge urn had been found with like 50,000 gold coins in it.
52,000 assorted coins were found this spring, I think, wasn't it?
But they weren't gold.
But they weren't gold.
They are. There are no gold coins. They were, if we're talking the same hoard, it was, yes, I guess you could call it an urn. It was a pot.
Where was this found?
It was found in Britain. Mm-hmm. And they are coins of the usurper, the Roman usurper Carausius, who ruled in Britain, among other places, and earlier emperors. But there were no gold coins there. But getting back to this Corinthian coin you have, one thing I would caution you and anybody else listening is don't look for bargains. If a coin is worth $600 and somebody offers you one for $90, make absolutely certain that it is authentic, because there are many fakes of these.
Our thanks to the caller. Let me read you an email I've got, which is curious. This fellow says, I have a U.S. penny that is, quote, half-stamped, meaning, he says, it looks as though when the penny was stamped in the machine, only half of it was properly machined. The other half is blank. Is this, it is rather the size of a regular penny. Value, question mark.
Value could be a few dollars, could be considerably more, not probably in the hundreds.
What's the story on this kind of penny?
The ejection system, when they spit these pennies out of the press, it's going at hundreds of strokes a minute. Sometimes they get caught, knocked into one another, stamped a second time, or catch the edge of the press. Not uncommon. You can see them on sale at coin shows, a few bucks each. You could show it to a dealer. He could look it up in a book and give you a rough idea. In the book here, they've got, they call it off-center is what they refer to it as. And it depends on how much off-center is dictates the price.
Now, here's another email that I don't fully understand. You will probably be able to explain it to me. Excuse me. I'm curious to see if the recent state quarters would ever be worth anything. That's a simple question. But then she says, my grandfather passed on to me many pill bottles sorted by state a few years ago. I have a feeling they won't amount to much more than a quarter, but I wanted to inquire. What does she mean by pill bottles?
People use medicine prescription bottles.
Literally
to store
pill
them
bottles.
In. Yeah, pill
it's
bottles.
Tubes. Just stack
plastic
them up.
Tubes. They stack them up. To answer the first question first, probably no value. They're just
they're worth a quarter.
Yeah, they're worth a quarter. Yeah. Brilliant uncirculated. Yeah, the early first dates have a little premium, but
have they been completed? My grandson is
collecting
all of them.
Did they finish up the territories now? Also, I think they
did. The territories are finished, and we're on the state parks now.
State parks. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Oh, then there are to be more than 50.
Well, yes, there's 50 states, there's six territories, and now we're doing the national parks, so who knows what they'll think of after that, the planets or something.
We're not big fans. We're not big fans.
Why not?
They're fleecing, they're squeezing the golden goose. The market can only absorb so much.
But they're not charging you more than a quarter for the quarter, are they?
No.
Buy from the mint, they charge a big premium.
Oh, do they?
Yeah, for the packaging and shipping and that. That's why a lot of times if you want a mint product, you can buy it on the secondary market a lot less expensively.
Well, you run into them in circulation just routinely.
That would be worn, and a collector would want one in beautiful, pristine condition.
I see. And with that, we're going to pause in a moment for an update on the news. If you've been trying to reach us all night, do continue to try. This is the sort of program I predicted that we would have loads and loads of callers for. And indeed, all of our lines are taken at the moment, but they empty when we process a call. Therefore, the number remains 312-591-7200. But another easy way to get to us, of course, and there's no limit on this, is email. The email address, extension 720 at WGNradio.com. If you're listening in Australia or in Malaysia or in Japan or on the Chinese continent, and we reach all of those places in midday via the internet, therefore we've got a fair number of listeners out there, by all means give us an email if you've got a question. For email again, extension 720 at WGNradio.com.
Milt Rosenberg, extension 720, Chicago's WGN Radio 720.
And the next caller coming up is Robert, who has a question for the two numismatic Roberts. Go ahead, sir.
Milt?
Yes.
Thank you so much for taking my call and your guest also. My question is, I'm 74 years old, and probably like many others, I've collected coins since I was a young 8 or 9 years old. And, you know, my coins are from the 19th century, and I have stamps from there. But they've been sitting around for many years, and I don't know what to do. I would love to go to a dealer, but I don't want to bore them with maybe just ordinary coins and stamps and things like that.
Do you live in Chicagoland?
Pardon me?
Do you live in the Chicagoland area?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Do you want to establish a value, or are you interested in selling them, or just passing them on to kids, or just do you know what you have? I should put it that way.
I know what I have. I have a lot of silver coins, and you know, it's one of those things that I've done for so many years, but do not know. You know, I'm at a point where my wife will say, oh, you got to sell them.
Yeah, what are you going to do with the stuff? The kids don't want it.
Exactly.
Let's go on vacation.
And, you know, so I really don't know what to do.
If you're looking for a suggestion, there'd be a couple ways to approach it. Number one, you could go to a dealer, establish a price, what he would charge for an appraisal, so many dollars per hour. It wouldn't necessarily be cheap, but you could get a good idea of a written appraisal, what everything's worth. You could then decide to sell it. They probably would waive the fee. And then, or you could go around and show this group of coins, if it's a suitcase or a briefcase or a steamer trunk, and try and match the price or better it. Or you could go to a dealer and say, go through it at your leisure and give me an idea what it's worth and then think about it. Those would be options.
I would pipe in that you might consider taking these to a coin show, not the stamps. There are a few stamp shows in the Chicago area, too. There you have the opportunity to see a number of dealers, and you can look around and see who carries the sort of stuff that you have.
I see.
And ask them.
Depends how many coins you have. Would they fit in a briefcase?
Probably more. It would probably be more than
a big bunch. A dealer's not going to want to go through them at a show, but you could bring a small quantity. There's the Illinois Numismatic Association, the ILNA show, coming up September 9th through the 11th in Tinley Park, and you can go to our club website and get information about that. That's probably where I would start. Talk to a couple people, say, I've got this stuff. Can I make an appointment?
May I ask you what the website is again?
I was about to ask. I want to repeat that. Yes. The website.
Yes.
I don't have
the Chicago Coin Club website. You could just search for Chicago Coin Club on Google and it will come up. I don't remember offhand.
Or, sir, you can simply go to our website, wgnradio.com/extension720, and the link to the Coin Club website is available right on the top of our website tonight. We thank you for the call, and quickly and directly to another, that other being Jerry, here on WGN Radio. Good evening.
Yes, sir. I'd just like to mention a book for your awareness. It's entitled Life in Year One, What the World Was Like in First Century Palestine by Scott Korb. He's a graduate of Union Theological Seminary, I guess it's called.
Yes.
And he discusses in there the coin known as the Plutarch, which was the coin of the Hashmonaim dynasty after Matisyahu that you mentioned earlier in the program. And a particular interest probably is the fact that he says that, quote, in other words, with first century coins, we can finally know one thing for certain about life in year one. Palestine was the Holy Land, and the people who lived there were Jews. How can we know this for sure? Because the coins that remain from first century Palestine are almost entirely what scholars call aniconic. I don't want to take too much of your time reading further. That I'll leave that to you if you think that this may be of interest to you. He has a whole chapter in this book called Money in Year One.
Mm-hmm. There was a paper presented at the International Numismatic Congress last September in Glasgow by Danny Sion, who is with the Israel Antiquities Authority, and he made a study of the coin finds in the Galilee at different periods of time based on archaeological records. And he found that along the coast, the coins were of the cities, the Roman cities with the pagan governments. Mm-hmm. But in the interior, they were Jewish coins, the Hasmonean coins, the Hasmonean dynasty. In later times, the second century, they were the Roman and Greek colonial coins circulated in the interior, but by the first century, they had been replaced almost entirely by the Jewish coins, which showed a Jewish settlement moving into the Galilee, which is very interesting, of course, because we know that's where Jesus came from at that time. And this paper, if you're interested in this, will probably be published within a year or so on the proceedings of the International Numismatic Congress. I believe that's the 12th International Numismatic Congress. Danny Sion, S-Y-O-N. And I think you might find that of great interest.
Our thanks to the caller. I'm sure he will find that of interest. What comes to my mind is the Jesus speaking when challenged as to whether he's loyal or disloyal to Rome. You remember, he pulls out a coin and he says, render unto Caesar, that which is Caesar's. So that this, what coin with Caesar's Caesar's portrait on it was he holding?
A denarius. Actually, in the Greek, it says denarius. Yeah. He says, show me a denarius. There's no mystery about what the coin is. Show me a denarius, which was the tribute money.
So whose portrait is on that coin?
Well, it says Caesar, but Caesar is generic at this time. It's like the president or something like that. It's usually assumed to be Tiberius Caesar, who was emperor from 14 to 37 A.D., which covers the entire ministry of Jesus. But
it might have been Augustus from an earlier
Might have been Augustus been, because at one time it was thought that the coins of Tiberius were scarce in excavations in Israel, although more have been found recently, whereas coins of Augustus are fairly common. So it could have been a coin of Augustus.
This is wonderful stuff. Back to the phones. 591-7200 is the number, and Bob is up next. Good evening.
Good evening, Milton. Thanks for taking my call.
My pleasure, sir.
I have a dollar bill that I received as change at an auto parts store, in fact, in about 1988 or 89. And the series date on it is 89. But the serial number and the seals are printed facing the top, where the rest of the bill is facing in the correct direction. And the margin at the top is double wide, and there's part of another five on the showing on it. Whereas the back of the bill is appears to be correct.
But the front is sort of a misprint, is it?
Yes, it's off register and misprinted.
Inverted numbers, letters. You really would have to have somebody look at that to authenticate it. Some people can get very clever with electric erasers or for cutting. If the back is in line, though, if you're in the Chicagoland area, I would take it to a shop, take it to a show, the Ilna show, one of the other local shows. There's one in Countryside every month. There are paper money specialists you could show that to, walk it around, and get some opinions.
It sounds like with inverted, the serial numbers and the seals are inverted, that's a third process. They're printed as the last process in printing the bill.
The backs are printed first.
Yeah, and actually authenticating it shouldn't be much of a problem because
Ortega is the name.
Yeah, that wouldn't Ortega thing wouldn't mean anything. But what I'm saying is that there's the dealers in errors, and there's a fellow Frederick Bart that comes
Frederick
to
Bart
mind
from Michigan.
Yeah, that specializes in currency errors.
Mark sets up at the Countryside. Yeah, there's several people to show it to.
He would know because it would be 12. Twelve notes would have this problem. It's not just one.
Right.
12 notes or 32, depending on 32. A whole sheet of 32 would have this issue, depending on how they cut them up. So very likely some of the others have turned up. So he would know, looking at the range of numbers, if it's in that range or not.
Yeah. Where is this at? He's in Michigan?
Are you in the Chicagoland area?
No, I'm in Lombard.
Oh, okay. There's a dealer called Gabe. Gabe's Coins in Glen Ellen. Gabe is knowledgeable, knows good people. He's in the Banyan Tree Mall. You could show that to Gabe.
Very good. All right, well, thank you very much.
We thank you, sir. Glad to have heard from you. And coming up next is Joe. Good evening.
Good evening. With regards to the artistic qualities of American coins, I'd be interested to hear your guest comments about the collaboration of Theodore Roosevelt and the artist Augustus St. Gaudens on the $10 and $20 gold coin pieces, and I'll listen off the air.
Oh, he's a miracle.
Yes, well, thank you. Augustus St. Gaudens was a great sculptor of that period.
Phenomenal.
Yeah.
Just phenomenal.
What coins is he referring to?
The $20 gold piece and the $10 gold piece, and entire books have been written on this subject. And in fact, just last week at the home in New Hampshire, there was a seminar with four speakers on this
really?
Subject.
St. Gaudens did beautiful sculptures for the Lincoln Memorial.
Yes. I know his home. It's in Cornish, New Hampshire. I used to work at Dartmouth College, not far away.
Called ASPIC.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure what I can add to this.
Teddy Roosevelt
was... describe the coin for us.
It's a $20 gold piece. It's gorgeous. Woman standing, walking, flowing gown. Teddy Roosevelt wanted to recapture the beauty of ancient Greece and coinage.
Uh-huh.
And met with Augustus St. Gaudens and showed him coins and said, I want our coins to look like this.
Uh-huh.
Really classy, world class. And he succeeded and hit it out of the ballpark.
The design is so beautiful that
it's what they use
the
in
U.S. Mint, when they began making bullion coins, could think of no way to improve it. And the obverse of the U.S. Gold American Eagle is St. Gaudens design, although unfortunately in lower relief.
But they did come out with it.
And so Teddy Roosevelt would not be pleased with that, but that's what it is.
Yeah. You're showing me a picture of it. It does indeed look like a very handsome coin. What's the handsomest U.S. coin in present circulation, would you say?
Present circulation. Good heavens. I don't know that any of them.
Or the least ugly.
Handsomest least ugly. Wow.
Actually, I like the Sacagawea dollar personally because that is a very original design. Goodacre, I can't think of her first name, did something extremely original. She saw Sacagawea facing away from the viewer with the baby looking out, and her head is turned.
Well, she's not clear who Sacagawea was. She was the Indian guide for Lewis and Clark.
Yes.
More than guide, she was.
Yeah. She was the wife of Charbonneau.
Yeah.
Charbonneau, the baby, his name is known. I can't remember his name.
Remember.
It's a French name. Yeah. Anyway, it's a very creative and original design, and unlike the usual profiles on everything else.
I like the reverse of our new cents because they've got a shield reverse reminiscent of the Civil War era tokens.
Hmm. We go back to the phones. No, we don't. I beg your pardon. We pause for a last round of commercials and then back to the phones. I see actually one line is now available. 312-591-7200.
This is Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg, Chicago's WGN Radio 720.
We've been talking with two of the leading people at the Chicago Coin Club, namely Robert Leonard and Robert Feiler. Leonard is the author of the recently published book, Curious Currency, The Story of Money from the Stone Age to the Internet Age. That's published by, who was it?
Whitman.
Whitman Publishers. And we go back to the phones, 312-591-7200, and Ray has joined us at WGN Radio. Good evening.
Hi, Milt.
Yes, sir.
Enjoying your program. Welcome to all the numismatists. I have one simple question.
You know, that's not an easy word to say.
Yes. I have one question. When was the coin first used in the world? Was it in Europe? Was it in Greece? Was it in China? Was it in Egypt? Where? Where did they first start to use coins?
I would bet that Robert Leonard knows the answer to that question.
The first gold and silver coins, first electrum coins, were used in Anatolia, that is in Turkey, in western Anatolia, in the late 7th century B.C., we think. 610, 620, that period.
620?
B.C., yes. Now, there are early, depending on what you consider to be a coin, there are... knife coins from China, which could be as much as a century earlier, and spade coins, spade-shaped coins and knife-shaped coins.
Spade.
A spade. They like a Chinese spade.
Like a calling card spade.
No.
Like a tool.
A modern spade has got one point. The Chinese spade has two points. It's square with a point on each end. And it's sort of like an inverted spade.
I hold in my hand a bulletin from the Chicago Coin Club about Chinese bamboo money, and indeed some bamboo money is affixed thereunto. What is that?
The bamboo money is much is not ancient. This is actually this 20th century.
Oh, really?
And For small change, of course, bamboo is very common, and for small change, pieces of bamboo, this is a piece of bamboo, sort of looks like a popsicle stick, only maybe thicker, with Chinese characters impressed into it, sort of like by wood burning.
You gave this to me. What is it worth?
Well, it's maybe $2-3 or something like
really?
That now. I mean, the market value.
We took it $5 in trade within a few months after its issue. It's one of the souvenir cards.
Did you give this to
do.
Me? Is this one of the things
it's,
I'm just
no,
looking
we
at?
No, we gave it to you. We gave it to you.
You're bribing
it's
the
one of our annual yeah. souvenir card.
It's really quite interesting looking.
To get back to the caller's question, is he
sure.
still here? Okay.
He is, yes.
There are early coins from India that are punch marked. They look like squares with a bunch of little punches, elephants and stars and so on in there. And those have been argued that they're also very early, but they're probably 4th century B.C. So I would say the earliest coins generally accepted now are the coins of Lydia in western Turkey. And the Chinese coins, if you consider them to be coins, they're not round, are somewhat earlier than that, but they are more like primitive money than round coins.
And let's work in a few more quick calls. There are just a few minutes left, but we go back to the phones at 591-7200, and Terry is next up. Good evening.
I want to jump way forward. For your guests are fascinating, and I want to know what their feelings are about what's going to happen in the future. You know, one of the things that I remember reading about, you know, 2 weeks ago is that GM will sell more cars in China than they will in the U.S. And what kind of impact does this have on the currency of the United States?
My crystal ball is broken. I don't know that it portends well for the future. I'm not sure.
I'm not sure I have any expertise in that. I think I'm going to have to beg off.
Yeah.
And let's take another question.
Yeah. This is higher economics.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, what do we know?
Okay.
What does the government have in store in the future just with regard to coinage and currency?
They're running the presses full time.
Yes, they are indeed.
They're
printing money.
$1 bill lasts for about 18 months. Yeah. They're shredding millions of dollars a day at each Federal Reserve to make room for new ones.
But they're also, in essence, inventing more money, aren't they?
Yes.
Which is a bit of a worry.
It's a big scare.
Our thanks to the caller, and we'll go quickly to another, probably the last. And coming up then is Donald. Good evening. You're on the air.
Good evening, Milt. Thank you. I know you're short of time, so I'm going to make it sort of rude and fast.
Good.
I have a Colombian Exposition coin. I believe it's from 1893, but don't quote me on that. My father gave it to me, and he always bragged that it was the only coin with Chicago printed on it. I have a two-part question here. Is that true? And if so, what is the value? I'll hang up and wait for your call.
All right. Thank you very much.
Control the time. Thank you, Milt. Bye now.
I think it's the only one with Chicago printed on it, 1892-93, the Chicago Columbian Exposition just south of here. Value, depending on condition, low-end $10, high-end, hard to say without seeing it.
It's the only United States coin that says Chicago, so that is true.
The first commemorative half dollar also.
Yes, probably it is the only coin. I can't think of any foreign coins that have Chicago also.
The only one I know of.
Sounds to me like a good souvenir that you ought to hold on to.
It is. They're great.
Or a good bit of memorabilia if you got it from his father. Well, we have come just about to the end of the available time. There isn't time for yet another call. What's the important question I didn't ask and that you could answer in half a minute?
I guess the most important question is, what is money? And the answer, I would say, is it's something that people have trust in, whether it be these copper crosses or whether it be a piece of paper that says this note is legal tender for all debts, public and private. If you trust that, then it is money.
I hope we go on trusting our money. I'm not sure that we necessarily will.
Yes.
With that, we really essentially are out of time. Let's just make clear that the new book by Robert Leonard is titled Once again, Curious Currency, The Story of Money from the Stone Age to the Internet Age. It's profusely illustrated and is, because I've looked at it rather closely, quite a fascinating book. He has been our guest, together with Robert Filer, both leading members of the... You're both, in fact, former presidents, are
yes.
you not?
Yes.
Of the Chicago Coin Club. And we thank you very much for being here. It's been a delightful evening. I look forward to being with you all of next week, Monday through Thursday, until Monday at 11, actually. A cordial good night to all.
The preceding was a production of 720 to Go.
For over three decades, Milt Rosenberg has been feeding your head. Get a mindful on Extension 720 on 720 WGN.